Testing, 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 testing. I'm say something. Say all of you say hello. 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 All right. Hello.
My part of the program would be Catawba Ceremony of the Peace Pipe. To Nunti the sun, may she warm us always with her rays. To Nunti Wichawakink, the night sun, may he always guide our paths in times of darkness. To Manahre, the earth, the mother of all living things. To the north wind, we ask that you do not freeze us with your icy winds. And to the south wind, may you always send your warm and balmy breezes. To the east wind, the bringer of rains that nourish the corn, beans, and squash. And to the west wind, may you send always your winds that purify the skies. And to Wahriwe, the creator of mankind, may his blessings be forever upon all of us. I have spoken. This is a pipe known as a war pipe. It is not known as a peace pipe. This was made by relatives of mine on the Catawba Indian Reservation in Rock Hill, South Carolina. The pottery, the clay, comes from a field which the Catawbas have been digging in for many, many years. This type of pipe, among many of the Plains Indians, was known as the pipe of peace. But the Plains Indians have an extension from the pipe that shoots forward, another part that attaches to the bowl. Anytime you see a pipe like this, it's a pipe of the southern tribes of Indians, Cherokee, Catawba, Creek, or Choctaw. This is another pipe which is known as the pipe of joy. You see, this is a very large bowl. When four people have a quarrel among the Catawbas, the chief calls the four people together. They fill this bowl with tobacco, and all four people smoke. And after they have finished smoking, no one is angry at each other anymore. This is called the pipe of joy. So there is a difference. This is the war pipe, and this is the pipe of joy. To sing a welcome song to you, to welcome all of you here to the program. May I ask, will you raise your hands, how many of you are new here? Oh, all right, there are quite a few. All right, I sing this welcome song to you. I am your friend anyway, but after this song, why, you know, it's really for sure. Arise in the morning, the first thing that people in the village do is to wash up. Now, even today, though they live just the same as you, there are some families who live near the river and who still wash their children the way that they have been washing them for thousands of years. If I could have, four younger boys, just boys this morning.
Did you ask for this book?
Yeah, I'm just trying to, well, I lift him, he's kind of heavy. Come on, anyways. That boy there, and you. All right. see, Indian boys, like other boys, really don't like to get washed up in the morning too much either. So the Catawbas have a song which makes a game out of getting the boys washed up. And the song sounds like this. Now, when they say t-coon, the boys who are carried under the arm are dipped head first down into the water. Boys, there's no real water here, so you don't have to worry about being any cleaner when you leave than you were. Now, we will imagine that this is the Catawba River, and this is very early in the morning. Anyone here who knows a dance called the Charleston? You two boys? Yes?
No?
Alright, let me ask again. Any of you familiar with a dance known as the Charleston? You know? Anyone else? Anyone else? You know the Charleston? All right. I'd like to teach you two words in Catawba. The words are weak hade. Can you say that?
Weak
hade. Once more.
Weak hade.
Yes. In Catawba that means do be quiet. Now, can you remember every time I say weak hade? Now, girls, there is a dance among the Indians of New York State, the Seneca, the Cayuga, and Onondaga. It is known as the fish dance. But these Indians say that many years ago, some tourists went to see some of their dances, and they saw this fish dance and came back to the city and did a dance almost like it and named it the Charleston. So I would like for you to see how the Charleston looks like the fish dance. So first I am going to do the fish dance. I'm going to do a little of it. When I finish, then I'm going to have you follow me around on the platform. And when I start to do the fish dance, you will start to do the Charleston as you know it. Now first I'll give you a little idea of how the Seneca's dance is. Now, you follow me around, just like this, you see? start the fish dance, then you, Charles, can lead it. Now, if you separate just a little bit, so you won't be as well. All right, follow me around, ready? Hallelujah, we eat it. Oh, who girls like this, girls? Hallelujah, we eat it. How did you know it was a gourd? Where did you see gourd?
Because you know the third grade started to walk down empty, and that's the first thing he studied about.
All right, I'm very glad to know that. This, in Catawba, this is called wade, which means, doesn't really mean gourd, it means fruit with a rind. This is a very important plant to the Indians who lived along the Atlantic coast. It was used for many, many, many purposes. For example, a gourd with a little, this gourd is broken, but a gourd with a little hole cut inside, minnows will stay, you know what a minnow is? Small fish. They will stay alive in a gourd for 2 or 3 days. They will not stay alive in anything any more than a day, but they will stay alive, they use them as bait, 2 or 3 days inside of a gourd. The Catawba Indians have found that by putting sugar and salt in gourds, that the damp weather doesn't affect it. You know how sugar gets sometimes when it's damp, it sticks all together? Sugar will stay dry inside of a gourd. When they're teaching young children to swim, they make, I think they call it, you know, water wings? Only they make them of gourds. They tie two gourds together, a string, and they put them under the children's arms, and the gourds will float the children upon the water. And at night, the Indians in Virginia, especially the Pamunkey, the Chickahominy, the Rappahannock, the Mattapani, they tie gourds painted black on their fishing nets, and they can see where the nets are located at night because of the light from the moon reflecting on the gourd, or the water reflecting on the shiny black surface of the gourd. There was an old Chickahominy Indian lady in Virginia who had her own set of scales made of two gourds. And there was a merchant who used to visit the Chickahominy Indians, and he used to sell them things such as dried beans and peas and rice and flour and cornmeal. And he had his scales. And so one day he sold this lady, this Chickahominy lady, a few pounds of dried whippoorwill peas. And, you know, he brought his scales out, and he weighed them, and told her how much they were. So then she called her grandson, and her grandson came out with her scales made from two gourds. And when she weighed the peas on her gourd scale, she found that the man had cheated her by almost a pound. So this is an interesting experience, because it shows how the Indian has even used these for modern things. Water, when dipped from a gourd, when the gourd is used as a dipper, when you drink water from a gourd, the gourd gives the water a taste that is very different and very pleasing. However, the gourds, when they're first grown, are poisonous. You could not just cut a hole in a gourd and use it to drink water out of, because it has a poison inside. And so boiling water is poured into the gourd. The gourd is scraped. Today it is, you use a teaspoon to scrape all of the poison pith from inside of the gourd. And the way that you test it is, you keep taking little sips of water, and if the water becomes, is still a little bitter, then you clean more inside of the gourd. until you don't have any bitter taste at all. And I have a friend in East Hampton who thought that this idea of the water tasting better from a gourd was just my own imagination. And so he said to me, he said, I don't believe that the water tastes any different from that than it does out of a cup. So I said, all right, I'll prove it. So I said, I'll turn my back, and you take some water out of the water pail. You take one dipper out with a gourd dipper, and take the other water out with a regular dipper or a cup. So he placed these two things in front of me, and he said, now I want to see if you can tell by tasting which came from the gourd. So I tasted both, and he had tried to fool me, but he had taken them both out with the gourd dipper, and it really does have a distinct taste of its own. The gourd is also important. It's a bird nest. The larger gourds is a bird in the southern states known as a purple martin. Any of you know what a purple martin is? Well, anyway, let me tell you about it. You know the crows always steal from the cornfield. Do you know that?
Yeah, of course.
So the crows go down into the cornfield and damage the corn crops. And so the southern Indians tie gourds on poles 20 or 30 feet in the air. And they put little holes in the bottom of the gourds so that the purple martins can make nests in there. The holes are placed in there because when it rains inside, it won't drown out the nest of the bird. The water will drain out. If a crow comes anywhere near a cornfield where there are purple martins nesting in gourds, purple martins, it's just like they go on the warpath. They come out of the nest and they drive the crows away all the time. It's really it's the best friend of any farmer. The purple martin. So they put these gourds up on posts, four ends of the fields. The gourd is also used to hold eggs. It is used, as I told you, as nests, as dippers. The big 2 and 3 gallon ones are used to carry water. And water will always be cool inside of a gourd. You'll always notice in the summer when you have water inside of the gourd that the outside will have little beads of water on there, but the inside will be perfectly cold. And that's the story of the gourd. This is another item which is very important to the Catawba Indians. It is also used by the Cherokee, the Chittimacha in Louisiana, some of the Creek and some of the Tunica in Louisiana. And it is called in Catawba language wansampuhan, or cane blowing. It is a blowpipe, or sometimes called a blowgun. Now the cane, which is called wansa, grows along the banks of the Catawba River. It grows sometimes 17, 18, and 19 feet tall. You cut the cane when it is green. You perhaps know this also as bamboo. And inside, there are sections. There are these sections. We take a locust stick and we punch through each section until the blowgun becomes hollow, as you see this one. And then to get all of the little pieces around from the edges, we take a stick that is just as wide as the inside of this barrel, and we ram it back and forth until it clears all of the pieces of these sections out. And to make it grow straight, tie heavy rocks on it, on the bottom, and put it up in a tree and forget about it for about a month. The weight from the rocks will make the cane or bamboo become straight. Then it is ready to be used for hunting small game, turkeys, partridge, pheasants. These are called wan. These are the darts. The darts are made of any light wood. Now, if a Catawba wants to make blowgun darts and he doesn't find any yellow pine handy, then he'll use any kind of light wood that he can find. It's wrapped with feathers, sometimes rabbit fur, sometimes thistle. Thistle is a flower, which has a white, furry-like flower. It's tied on the end. It's placed in here like this, when it fits in snug like this, you boys probably know something about compression. This gives it the force that you need to ram it out. Now, if it isn't too much trouble, and if you could turn around very orderly and look this way, I will shoot the dart all the way down the end of the wall. Blowgun is also a friend. Young boys get very excited when learning to hunt with a blowgun, and they wander very far from home and sometimes get lost. So anytime you hear anyone say Indian boys never get lost, that's not always true. They get excited and do go far away from home. But if they get lost, all they simply do is to use the blowgun like this, and the people can tell where they are and come and get them. The hunters know that someone's lost. The boys keep blowing on this. Someone will come and help them to get home again. I'd like to teach some of you another dance. I don't want to teach you just all Catawba dances. There's a dance among the Creek Indians who now live in the state of Oklahoma. It's called the Green Corn Dance. Now, I would like to have all of you sing part of the song with me. When I sing, "Weha yole hey," everyone answers, "Yole hey." Can you try that? Listen to me now. "Weha yole hey."
Yole hey.
"Weha yole hey."
Yole hey.
"Weha yole hey."
Yole hey.
That was good. "Yole hey." And then I say, once more. "Way hi yole hey."
"Yole
hey." "Way hi yole hey."
"Yole
hey." "Way hi yole hey."
"Yole
hey." "Way hi uh-huh." Then you answer, "Way hi uh-huh." Try that. "Way hi uh-huh." Try it again. "Way hi uh-huh." "Way hi yole hey." "Yole hey." Try it again. "Way hi yole hey."
"Yole hey."
"Way hi yole hey."
"Yole hey."
"Weha yole hey."
"Yole hey."
"Weha uh-huh." "Weha uh-huh." "Weha yole hey." "Yole hey." Now let's have some dancers here. Now wait, relax. You know, I have a wonderful idea, but you can only do this with me if you can do this orderly. And if you can do this orderly, we can do it exactly like the Creeks do out in Oklahoma. But you must promise me that, can you do this dance, all of you with me, if we were to do the stomp dance around the hall, could you, when the dance is finished, could you quietly go back to your seats without running and pushing? All right, now, if you can do this, because this is exactly the way the stomp dance is done. You sing and you dance at the same time. You have to follow every move that I make. Now, if you can do this, if you would all stand. Now, here's what, now, this will make it very simple. The first row here will follow me. And then the next row, and the next row, and the next row, and the next row. This sounds very complicated, but they dance sometimes 700 and 800 children. And I'm sure that if they can do it, that you can do it the same way. When all of this row, and I'll simplify that. We'll use just this section first, and then I'll come back, seek you, and then I'll dance with this.
So you people can sit down.
Everyone will have a chance to dance. In the meantime, you must sing along with me. You sing along with us.
Thank you.
This is called Wedeboye Tusa, or deer tail. It is a headdress which is used by the Catawbas many years ago. The Senecas and other Iroquois tribes also use this type of headdress. The reason I would like to explain it to you is, one time many years ago, in about 1712, the English were fighting against the Cherokee Indians down in North Carolina. And they had some Catawbas fighting on the side of the English. And the English were shooting some of the Catawbas by mistake, thinking that they were Cherokees, because it was hard to tell the difference because their costumes were pretty much alike, the way that they dressed. And so during the battle, when one Catawba saw what was happening, they called all the Catawba together, and they found out the English had wounded a number of Catawbas by accident. And so in the next battle, when they went against the Cherokee, all the Catawba men wore the deer roaches, the deer tail, in their hair. This way the English knew who was Cherokee and who was Catawba. And I thought I would tell you about that. This is from the deer known as the Virginia deer. Now, you see, it's the tail of the deer. There's a bone in the tail. You split it and remove the bone, and then you stretch this. And you stretch this for about 2 weeks. Then you put salt on it, and you cure it. And to keep the hair in good condition, you can put different types of oil on it and brush it up and comb it up. This is an important type of a headdress for the Indians of the East Coast. I'm sure we have played this game before. You know, so far since I have introduced this game to various schools, particularly on Long Island, just about everywhere that we have gone, the girls' teams have always managed to beat the boys. And, now, that is not, that's not a very good way. Taboo is very bad. Of course, this is one thing that the Indians don't do. This game is a test of skill. You catch it here, and you score 5 points. Now, for little children, we use these rows here, these rows. But I can see that I don't have to do that with any of you here. So we will just count the center. And if I can have 6 boys. Now, don't get excited. Wait a minute. And 6 girls. We will have time for just one game. This will give you a chance to. Let me ask this. How many of you here have played this game before? Raise your hands. Those of you who have played it before. Well, that doesn't help my little plan anymore. But nevertheless, let's see. All right, you. Yes, yes, come on. You. You. Yeah. Don't run now. Take your time. Well, I was calling girls, but come on, since you're up here. All right. Let's see. That girl there with the white blouse. You. Yes. How many girls do we have? Over here.
Five.
We only have 5? We need... All right. We have 6 now. Now, and boys. That boy, that very quiet boy. All right, so come on. All right, the boy with the glasses, come on. How many, watch your tape, watch your wire, boys. How many? 3, 6. Now, here's what we're going to do. I want to make this game simple. Sometimes everyone gets excited. I don't want anyone to put a stick through someone else's head. So What we are going to do is to give you or your team's names, and then we will have one boy on this side, one girl on that side. When you have finished, then you will just come back up on the stage. This way there won't be everyone in each other's way. Now, will you pardon me a moment while I get the rest? All right, fellas, we're going to, we'll call these girls, let's see, the Shining Flowers. Well, I'm looking them over. 5, 6. You got a pretty rugged voice. Young Eagles. Now, the object of the game is just to catch it here. So, we'll have the first girl down here. And the first boy. All the way over. Back further, all the way back. Right. You all right now? All right. Catch it in the middle to score. Help! Oh, she did.
We'll have no more bullying. No more bullying.
Yay! No, nothing. No score. Next girl. Next girl. Oh, all right. Next boy.
5-0. The girl's leading.
No, no score.
Oh, ready?
No score.
Go back a little bit, Attica. Wait till
the window. I want to see you do it.
That's...
Oh, no score. To win, and then they sort of lower their guard. Good audience. I hope that you learned something, and you know, time flies very rapidly, and it is time to end our program. I wish all of you a very happy New Year. Thank you.
I'll tell you, we just have just a few more minutes, perhaps a few questions.
Well, all right.
Would you like to ask any questions? I know that there are a number of new people here, and perhaps if you just tell us where Indians are in New York State.
Well, we'll start with Upper New York State first. There are the Senecas. They are one of the six Iroquois tribes. They have one reservation, Cattaraugus Reservation, 27 miles east of Buffalo. There's another group of Senecas that have a reservation near the city of Akron. And another group of Senecas have a reservation down on the border of Pennsylvania and New York, Allegheny Reservation. Then there are the Mohawks, who are the among the most well-to-do dairy farmers in New York State. They have a reservation up at St. Regis, which is near the Canadian border, all the way up near Malone. Then there are the Onondagas, who have a reservation 7 miles outside of the city of Syracuse. And the Oneidas, another New York tribe, have just a little reservation near Oneida, New York. Most of them moved out to Wisconsin. They live today out in Green Bay, Wisconsin, about 2,000 of them. They left New York in about 1781, after the Revolutionary War. The Cayugas, also another New York State tribe, don't have any reservation in New York. And they live as guests among the Senecas on the Cattaraugus Reservation. Those are the Iroquois tribes. Now, out on Long Island, there is the Shinnecock Reservation near the village of Southampton. And there is the Puspatuck Reservation near the town of Mastic. And the Montauk Indians left Long Island in 1832 and moved out. First, the Montauks moved up to Oneida, New York, among the Oneida Indians. And they formed a town called Brothertown. They stayed there 25 years. And then when the settlers began crowding the Indians out, this time, the Montauks, together with the Narragansetts from Rhode Island, the Pequots and the Mohegans from Connecticut, they bought 20,000 acres of land from the Winnebago Indians out in Calumet County, Wisconsin, and they moved out there by covered wagon to Wisconsin. And it's interesting to know that these Eastern Indians were going west by covered wagon, and they were at one time attacked by a group of Chippewa Indians. And it wasn't until the Chippewa Indians really got really close to them that they recognized that these people were Indians who were dressed the same as whites. And they moved out to Wisconsin. The Montauk Indians helped to found the first Baptist church in the state of Wisconsin. And three of those people from the Montauks and those other eastern tribes that moved out there have been members of the Wisconsin State Legislature. Today on Long Island, there are only 7 Montauk Indians left. One of them is, her name is Pocahontas Farrow. She lives in East Hampton. She's 87 years old. She is the last Indian living who was born at Montauk Point before it was sold. You know, it was an Indian reservation until 1879. And then it was bought by the Long Island Railroad. She made this brush, which is called a scrub. And this is a very popular brush on Eastern Long Island. This is used by housewives out there in place of Brillo, steel wool, and many other things. Because no matter what they say in the commercials about how they make the pot shine, this little brush will last sometimes 5 and 6 years. And she makes these now. She's an old lady. She's not able to cut the wood anymore, so I go out into the woods and cut the white oak sticks for her. She whittles these down herself. She whittles all of these, see all these little splints? They're done by keeping it in a pail of water, and then it's it's wet and keeps it from snapping off. You find these in any of the hardware stores on Eastern Long Island. This is called a scrub. And this is made by a Montauk Indian. And that's where your Indians
are. Would you say something about the Indians who live in New York City?
In New York City, there are several Indians representing several tribes. There are more Mohawks, as far as we know of, However, you see, in New York City, and in the census, in the Census Bureau, the census does not register Indians who come from other countries. In New York, we have an awful lot of Indians, let's say from the San Blas tribe, who live off the coast of Panama. We have a number of Mexican and Peruvian Indians in New York. We have, let's see, we have several Cherokees. We have Yaqui, there are some Apache, some Navajo, Choctaw, Creek, Chickasaw, Winnebago, Hopi, Carib, Quechua, Tlingit, Tsimshian. These are Alaskan Indians.
All of them live here in New York City.
In New York City, and many of them, we have one Indian, very good friend of mine, who made this ring, incidentally. He is a silversmith. He works in a store called the Wigwam in the Port of Authority bus terminal. We have a number of Mohawks who work in the buildings. There are Mohawks now. Yes, there are Mohawks now and working on the Manhattan Bridge, rebuilding it. The Mohawks started doing this years ago, working in the skyscrapers, because there was a bridge going to be built over the St. Lawrence River. And the Mohawks wouldn't give their consent to have the bridge go over the reservation unless their men could work on the crew. And so they just became pretty good iron workers. They weren't afraid of being up very high. And but it isn't only Mohawks, because out in the West Coast, the Apaches are also just as good in high steel. And there are several other Indians that have tried this. The Mohawks have wanted the monopoly of being the only Indians who could do high steel. But now there are several Mi'kmaq Indians in Canada and some Huron Indians who are working with these Mohawks in high steel. It's just a matter of the individual. And the Indians in New York City, they send their children to school. There are some Indian children attending school up, I can't think of the school now, but it's up near, I think it's near Bleecker Street. And the children do the same things that you do in school, and they're just the same as anyone else. They don't, beg pardon?
What kind of school?
They go to the public schools. I'm not sure of the number, but I know the children live on Charles Street. Yes. Anything else?
My grandmother lives in Tappahannock, Virginia, right near the Rappahannock River.
Oh,
and
yes.
And my family went down there this summer, and we found three arrowheads on the beach. It was right near the beach.
Yes, I have.
And she found an Indian skull and three other beaches.
I have a number of, that's right near the Rappahannock Indians. The Rappahannock Indians live in Indian Neck, Central Point, Alps, Beasley, and all those little villages there. They're very good fishermen.
Well, I'm sorry.
All right, Mr. Studer.
Time is up.
All right.
And thank you very much.
All right.
When you think of refrigerators, you think of Frigidaire. When you think of facial tissues, you think of Kleenex. When you think of masonry paint, you think of Bondex. But there is only one Bondex. So, know your onions about the greatest name in masonry paint.
Introduced in 1923, Bondex has become established in worldwide markets. Bondex is manufactured by the Riordan Company, founded in 1883. It was Riordan that in 1903 produced the first casein paint in America. Then in 1923, Riordan produced the first cement paint, Bondex.
Wherever one works to beautify and protect masonry surfaces, Bondex provides the answer for both protection and beauty. During its dramatic rise to world popularity, Bondex has been applied to bridges in Florida, schools in Manila, churches in Vancouver, apartment houses in Norway.
Bondex is on the market in your hometown. whether you live in the north, in the south, in the east, in the west. In fact, the Bondex market includes any building anywhere with a porous masonry surface.